Morning, everyone. The E-12 Education Finance Division will come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 12, 2014. Today we have two bills before us, Senate File 2247 and 1891. First, we'll start with Senator Tomassoni, Senate File 2247. Welcome to the committee, Senator Tomassoni. And for members, we do have some handouts, including the summary fiscal note, plus an author's amendment, A3, which Senator Johnson will offer in your behalf. Senator Johnson moves the A3 amendment. We'll note the quorum, but we're going to have it for information for us, so there's logic in the testimony. So we will have that before us. We'll take action, but just so members will look at it. We also have an unofficial engrossment which incorporates the A3 with the bill as originally introduced. So we'll take action on that, but for purposes of your presentation, I think you're going to be incorporating that language. So welcome, Senator Tomassoni.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. You guys are good. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2247 is designed to allow three independent school districts in northern Minnesota to co-locate and build a new grade school in their grades 7 through 12. The three districts are Mountain Iron, Buell, Virginia, and Evelyn Gilbert, and they have a total of 1,400 students in grades 7 through 12. Each of the independent school districts has high schools that have been built between 1910 and 1919, and they would require a total of about $63 million in upgrades. So it makes some sense to join together and build a new modern school. The total 712 space would be reduced from 800,000 square feet to 315,000 square feet. The bill addresses these key issues. It allows a joint powers agreement between the schools to manage and operate the new school. It makes the new joint powers agreement eligible for a consolidation grant if they ever become available through capital bonding. It increases transition aid to $300 per year for 5 years for consolidated or co-located districts. It eliminates the net market value cap on the three districts so they can allocate bonding debt for new construction to maximize state aid. It requires a public vote in each of the three independent school districts, and it creates an Iron Range School Construction and Improvement Trust Fund to help pay for the new construction by allocating taconite production taxes and royalty taxes to the trust fund. The bill would help four current districts, which recently consolidated, with increased transition aid, and it may also become a model for other districts as a step to cooperate and share programs. The main goal here is to increase the variety and quality of the curriculum for the students in the three districts while maintaining a vibrant and community-based elementary education program in the communities. Mr. Chairman, the bill before us comes as a result of the three school boards in the three districts voting to do this. And the bill is an attempt to provide funding and to make sure that in the event that the votes in the districts go the way of a yes vote, that the funding is available in order to make the building happen. So with that, I can turn this over to either one of my witnesses here.
Thank you, Senator Tomassoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Cirkvenek. I represent the school districts of Virginia and the consolidated school districts of Mountain Iron, Buell, and Eveleth and Gilbert, who are the three participating districts in this plan. And what you have before you is Senate File 2247, and I'll walk through the major items in the bill, and then we also have testifiers from the three school districts who'd like to give their perspective, school board members. Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Mr. Cirkvenek. For members just arriving, we haven't taken official action on the A3, but we're going to incorporate that by reference for testimony, and there's an unofficial engrossment which embraces the A3. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On subdivision 4 on line 1 is cooperative owned operated secondary facilities. In the 1980s, the legislature passed a cooperative grant program for consolidated districts through capital bonding, and six districts consolidated and used about $35 million at that time. There's no money in the program, and I believe the bonding committee is not considering any this year. However, It would make a cooperatively operated school district like we're proposing eligible in the future for any grants that may come through capital bonding. The second major thing is under Section 2, where we expand the joint powers authority that would allow these three school districts to operate cooperatively through a joint powers agreement. And the main item I think that you need to look at is on Subdivision 5, the estimated market value limit exclusion. This would allow the three districts to allocate the debt on the project to the three districts to maximize state equalization aid. Subdivision 8 authorizes the bonds and would require a public vote by the majority of those voting in each one of the three districts to allow the project to move ahead. That's the main item there. On Subdivision 2, I missed that on page 2, you should note that the Department of Education would be required to review and approve the plan, and it would have to have expanded curriculum offerings. On page 3, on Consolidated Transition Aid, on line 3.5, right now the legislature has passed and you have funded a transition aid program for consolidated school districts that provides an additional $200 per pupil per year for consolidated districts in the first year, an additional $100 in the second. This section of the statute increases that to $300 for 5 years and makes a cooperatively located school district eligible for that expense. And the amendment eliminated the 2,000 pupil limit on that. The next major items then go into the taconite tax issues that the tax committee, I'm sure, will be dealing with, Mr. Yes. Chairman, so you probably don't want me to go into too many details on that, outside of the fact that we're creating an Iron Range School Improvement and Trust Fund and taking existing taconite revenue, reallocating that, and having a royalty tax of 5.5%, putting it into a fund and allowing cooperatively operated and jointly operated facilities to be eligible for that. That's where a lot of the debt payments will come to help do this building, which is about $110 million in size. So those are the main points of the bill, Mr. Chairman, and I think we have our testifiers if you'd like to proceed with them.
Members, questions before we proceed to additional witnesses? Okay, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Betsy Olivanti. I am a school board director on the Mountain Iron Buell School Board, and I'm also a member of the joint committee between Virginia, Evelyn Gilbert, and Mountain Iron Buell. What I'd like to talk to you about most or primarily is the curriculum and the challenges that we face as small districts located on separate campuses and how that would be enhanced when we join together in a co-located campus. In rural small school districts, we have several grades that are single-section grades. So this creates some scheduling difficulties with many one-section classes. And, of course, we've gotten creative over the years, and we have combined some of our grade levels. So some of our 10th, 11th, and 12th grade courses are offered every 3 years, and those students are together in classrooms to accommodate that. Further, we don't have all industrial technology equipment and classes offered on each of our campuses, so students are bused between the three different campuses in order to offer those different technology courses right now. And we've cooperatively done that in the past. However, that does mean that students either leave a class early to arrive at the other campus and then arrive back to their home campus late. So that impacts the instructional time in the other courses that they're taking. Additionally, it limits some of our fine arts, vocal music, instrumental music, and art classes, performing arts, those sorts of things that we're able to offer due to the limited enrollments and things on our individual campuses. And exploratory programs for students, you know, to find out which careers and things that they're interested in have been either reduced or eliminated because of limited enrollment. So industrial technology, facts, exploratory programs, AP courses, things of that nature, which offers our students then limited opportunities to find out where their strengths and interests lie for when they start attending college. and things like that. So allowing us to co-locate on one campus offers some enhanced curriculum options and for which address those issues. Student travel time would be eliminated because the vocational courses would all be on one co-located campus, and students would all have access to that. We also enhance our overall structure of curriculum. So we could offer more STEM classes, science, technology, engineering, and math, and prepare them for those coursework, robotics, career exploration, possibly some internships that we can start facilitating, more electives, increased foreign languages and things like that, and increased opportunities in fine arts with group ensembles, advanced theater, additional courses like that, instead of just extracurricular or students finding those outside of the school day. It would be allowed during their regular curriculum courses. And then we could focus more on special education and certain advances that have been coming along there in education, more challenging courses, advanced placement, concurrent enrollment, and things like that. And we would also allow for more efficient use of our teachers' subject matter expertise and things like that. So those are some of the enhancements that we're looking for in this co-located campus.
Thank you, Ms. Olivanti. For the record, a quorum's present. Recently arriving members, we noted that we have an author's amendment. This is the first stop. It's the A3. Senator Johnson moves the A3 amendment. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
It's carried. And the A3 is incorporated in an unofficial engrossment that's before you. Please proceed. And we will, after the testifiers, we'll hear from Mr. Wilms with some of the financial implications. And I don't believe the department is scheduled to testify, but they certainly are encouraged to weigh in if they would, as there's reference in the bill to their involvement. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Steve Georgie. I'm with the Mountain Iron Buell School District, board member for 8 years. Lifetime resident of the city of Mountain Iron and a former member of Local 1938, which is at U.S. Steel Mintec plant in Mountain Iron. Just want to give a kind of a historical perspective on how we got to this position of talking about a co-located campus. The Mountain Iron Buell District in 2008 and 2009, along with the Virginia School District, we got a grant from the IRRRB to do a consolidated study on what a co-located campus would look like or coordinated effort for curriculum. We brought in SEH, and they did a complete analysis of both districts, looking at buildings, looking at curriculums, extracurricular activities, etc. At that time, MIB had 305 students in the 7th through 12 grades.
Excuse me, Mr. Yes. George. The shorthand. We're being televised, SEH, Short Elliott, Hendrickson, MID, Mount Iron Buell. I believe we know, but.
Yep. All right. And today we have 214 students in our 7th through 12 grades. So our district is, facing these declining enrollments and challenges, but also our building issues. At the time, Short Elliott Hendricks did their analysis of our building. They determined that it would be a little over $16 million for us to repair and upgrade our high school facility, which was built in 1919, to get it up to code electrically, for heating improvements and building efficiencies, etc. We have a cracked building foundation because we're in the mining blast areas from U.S. Steel. Our pool has been cracked for probably 25 years. It has daily leakage, so we're constantly filling and heating our pool if we try to utilize it. So we began this year to do a comprehensive long-range plan for the Mountain Iron Buell District. It was determined by the community that we definitely were in need of a new high school facility. We have a Merritt Elementary location, which is directly off of Interstate 169, which is centrally located in our community and is only about a mile from the Virginia school district boundaries. We have 52 acres there. We have plenty of site for additional facilities. So we brought in a few architectural firms to bring in renderings for a new campus for our district, and those price tags came in at about $21 to $25 million. We decided to meet with the Range delegation to see if there was something that they could assist us with in pursuing this. And at that time, the Virginia School District, basically unbeknownst to us, passed a resolution to relocate their 7 through 12 high school campus in Mountain Iron at the Merritt location. So now we've got our neighboring district, which is significantly larger than us, that has similar building issues. Theirs is also constructed in 1919. They have significant issues on their structure, and they've decided that they would be willing to relocate to our district and create a co-located campus. So we both passed resolutions of support to move forward with that concept. Again, the identity being separate districts but in one physical location. The benefit to the Mountain Iron Buell District is we get the students and the staff that we need to provide enhanced curriculum opportunities to our students. We just do not have enough bodies to be able to provide a variety of classes, etc. So, again, if we're going to do this, we want a world-class facility to meet the demands that the legislature put on us last year with a world-class workforce. And, we have several hurdles to accomplish that. So we're hoping that this new campus would be a world-class facility that would allow us, as Ms. Olivanti testified, to provide that broad spectrum of curriculum and really focus on a vocational path and curriculum for our students, so they would have enhanced opportunities to actually get jobs in the mining companies that surround our communities. Once we began these discussions, then the next community to the west, to the east, Eveleth-Gilbert, which is a previously consolidated district, decided that they wanted to be part of this discussion. They passed a resolution at their board that they would also relocate their 7 through 12 facility to the Mountain Iron location. So, now we've expanded it into the three neighboring communities in the central part of the Iron Range. We are certainly hoping that we can find support for this. We believe we've put together a creative funding package along with the utilization of the taconite taxes that are generated in these three communities. We generate over 40% of the total taconite tax on the range in these communities. The U.S. Steel facility is a $1 billion largest taconite producing plant in the world. It's within our district boundaries, and we believe that it's high time that they paid back our communities and our future generations by affording us this opportunity. We know we have some logistical hurdles to deal with, but we're hoping that this year we can get support from the legislature to move forward, put together a concrete plan that the Department of Education will support, and that we can make this a reality for future generations on the range. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Georgie, and for your service. And Senator Tomassoni, I notice Alavante Georgie Tomassoni. There's a strong Italian.
40.
Yes. Okay, please proceed.
Nothing going on that I know of. But you know, America.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, my name is Mark Forty. I'm currently a member of the Eveleth-Gilbert School Board. Began my career school boarding back in the 80s, member of the Eveleth School Board. Went through the consolidation with Gilbert. Very successful process. That was completed, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s. Now I find myself in another similar situation. Mr. Georgie mentioned that Mountain Iron Buell in Virginia started the process. A couple of our board members observed their early meetings, realized they had a good plan, the way they were going about the process. Went back and discussed it in our board and wanted to become a part of that. You've seen numbers on enrollment, but I think another way to look at it is when Mountain Iron Buell and Virginia were talking about co-locating, Virginia's student body would have increased by 30% by taking in MIB. Mountain Iron's student body would have gone up by more than four times. Significant increases, which would lead to improvements in curriculum. When Eveleth Gilbert voted to become part of the process, those dynamics changed a little bit. Now we're looking at Mountain Iron Buell's student body, if you take in Virginia and Eveleth Gilbert, increased by more than seven times. Eveleth Gilbert's increased threefold, three times as many students to provide enhanced curriculum. Virginia's went from an additional 30% to doubling. So we all have greatly benefited by increasing the students that are available curriculum-wise. It's been mentioned about the capital spending that our separate districts are doing, and I think in your handout, Eveleth Gilbert is looking at $12 million. $8 million of that would be to redo, improve our heating system, which is very old. Our building is also 100 years old. There's $4 million in out of that $12 million would go for vocational improvements if we wanted to keep our students on our campus for vocational purposes. Right now, when we transport them, mainly to Virginia, we spend $40,000 a year just to move those vocational students to classes outside of our district. So that would be a savings. That's basically all I have to contribute. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fortin, for your service. Senator Tomazoni, additional testifiers before I ask staff?
I don't think I have any. Anybody else?
Thank you. Mr. Pagel, you just saying hi? Okay, good. Hi. Senator Saxaw, I'm going to ask Mr. Wilms to comment on some fiscal impacts, and we'll open it up for questions shortly.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I just wanted to briefly mention that we do not have a fiscal note yet on this proposal. It has been requested, but given the considerable complexity here, it has taken a little bit more time than we expected, but I will get that to you as soon as possible. The main areas of cost considered, as mentioned, is under the cooperative facilities grant through bonding, the consolidation transition aid, and then additional debt service equalization aid due to the ability to allocate debt among districts.
Thank you, Mr. Wilms. And did the department like to comment at this point, Mr. Cordy?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. Darren Cordy with the Minnesota Department of Education. Just wanted to thank the school districts involved have reached out to the department already to have us take a look and do some kind of an informal review and comment on the bill. I understand that the superintendents met with Dr. Melcher yesterday on this and have kind of tried to walk through the process. As Mr. Wilms said, it's a pretty complex proposal, so I think we're still trying to wrap our heads around it. But certainly, you know, we are working with the districts to try and make sure that all the moving pieces work together.
Thank you. Mr. Pagel.
And Mr. Chairman, before Mr. Pagel goes ahead with his testimony, I want to point out that the major part of the funding package here is involved with the taconite provisions of the taconite tax code, and Mr. Pagel might not agree with some of the things that we're doing here, but the fact of the matter is that I think there's ways to either do it the way we're doing it or change the way we're doing it, and so there's some flexibility involved here, and several different provisions in the taconite codes that can be changed, as well as different ways of raising the money. So what's in the bill right now is a suggestion, and it may be a really good suggestion. It may not be a good suggestion, but we're going to be working with people to try and figure out exactly where to go next with this so that we can figure out how to get it done in the best way possible.
Thank you. Mr. Pagel.
Hi, my name is Craig Pagel. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association, known as the IMA, up in northern Minnesota. I'm here today, and it's always difficult because I'm testifying against a part of the bill of my favorite senator. So
that's today I'm his favorite senator.
Okay, no, we're enjoying this.
I made the mistake once of saying he was my favorite senator in the room once, and haven't been let go of that comment yet. The Iron Mining Association is made up of the six taconite mines, several scram mines that are now developing, and another larger mine, that taconite mine that's being built at this time. We appreciate the ability to and the opportunity to comment on Senate File 2247. While the IMA does support education, and we support the idea of consolidating these facilities for the very reasons that you've heard, the one part that we're not in favor of is the funding package as it is laid out. A 5.5% excise tax, and what I'm talking about is on Section 9 of the bill. I don't have the engrossed, so it might be a little bit different on yours. But it creates a 5.5% excise tax on mineral royalties paid to private fee holders. However, the mines pay those taxes. Based on last year's $100 million royalty payments from the mines to private fee holders, would generate $5.5 million per year if the royalties stay at that level. As we understand, there will be more mining of state, of private land as well. So that number could go up. Excuse me. And the payments are made because of a contract, and the contracts are as specific. It says, leasee agrees before penalty attaches for non-payment to pay all taxes, general or specific, upon the demise lands, which may be assessed either against said lands or the improved thereon or upon iron ore product. As I noted, we do support not only the idea of these school districts working together, but I think we need to also point out that the iron mining industry does pay quite a bit in education as well. Last year, in 2013, Iron Mines paid over $72 million in royalties that went to trust funds. K-12 trust fund received $50,048,000 approximately. University trust fund, $17.8 million. However, we also pay a production tax and an occupation tax. Of that, just in the occupation tax, K-12 received $8.7 million to that trust fund. We also pay a production tax, and about $17 million went to local school districts. And I'd also point out that last year we had taxes increased by $2 million. So there might be some money available in one of these funds that could help fund this project, which we think is a good project. And I'd stand for any questions.
Mr. Pagel, one of the points on the handout, Better Together and with the three groups, there was a bullet point regarding the problem being addressed, the old inefficient buildings, and these truly are amongst the oldest buildings deteriorated in the state. But underneath that, it says, in part, because of damage by mining blasting. Comment on that.
I guess what I would say is if there has been that type of damage, I would think that those school districts would work with the specific mines. And I would think that if they can prove that there was damage, they'd probably be able to take it forward from there and continue to work with those mines. I think what would be important to point out is this tax, if it's an excise tax on royalties, you might have a mine that's nowhere in the school district paying for this $5.5 million. It would be coming from a school district that might have already gone through bonding.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pagel. As was noted, Tax Committee will have jurisdiction, but we're aware.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I want to get into a discussion right now about this either, but like I said earlier, it's one of the possible places that we could potentially get some funding. It's an interesting arrangement between the mining companies and the royalty fee holders, because the fee holders don't pay any taxes, but the mining companies pay the taxes for the fee holders. And for some reason, it seems to me that maybe that arrangement should be changed and the fee holders should actually pay the taxes. Some of the names of the fee holders are names like Rockefeller or in Pillsbury and those types of names, you know. So they could probably afford to pay the taxes. And I just don't know if there's a way for the mining companies to change the agreement that they have with them. But I got a funny feeling they have some pretty good lawyers, and there's a chance that they could probably figure something out. It's a way of possibly doing this. But I don't know if Mr. Cervenic wants to comment on it. He has a handout of some interesting statistics over the years of taconite production taxes and the cost of ore. I for one, and I think the entire Range delegation is always very cognizant of the fact that our main industry, which is the mining industry, is what we live and die on, and it's a boom and bust type of industry. And I've always said that when the steel industry gets a hiccup, the Iron Range gets the flu. And so we have to always be aware of these types of issues. And so I think there's room for lots of discussion here. So I'm not going to say one way or the other that this is the right way to do it or the wrong way to do it, but it's a suggestion and it's a possibility of that of how we could get this done.
Okay, we have three members with questions, Senators Saxog, Dahl, and Dames. And Senator Bach. Senator Saxon.
Oh, sorry. I thought you said Senator Bach.
excuse me.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I fully support this in a big way. And it's one of those things we've been working at on the Iron Range to continue to improve our education system, which is already pretty good. But my question, I've got two questions, actually, and collaboration versus consolidation, and the financial advantages of both. And I understand, obviously, that it's a big step for. It would always be a big step for Eveleth and Virginia to be a consolidated school district. That's kind of like Greenway and Grand Rapids, I guess, or something like that. But. When we get down to the nitty-gritty here, have you considered what the financial implications of both?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxog, I think the main thing that you should be comfortable with is that the three districts are working on a cooperative plan that would bring down to one superintendent from three. They would share that they would share business offices and staff, and there's some discussion of, you know, how would you cut potential other positions, because schools, really their biggest costs are positions. However, as we move forward together, we currently have about 1,420 students, but the projections are for these three school districts between 2014 and 2020 that will actually gain 160 students. So you can't really cut teachers and cut support staff when you're increasing enrollment. These are lean districts right now. They're not overstaffed. They don't have too many teachers. However, we do have enough flexibility, I think, between now and when a new school building would be open, which would be 2017 or 2018. There are 12 positions in the teaching staff who are going to retire in that time period. And so I think from a cost standpoint, we'll be cheaper. We'll drop it from 800,000 square feet down to 300,000 square feet, roughly. Operating costs are going to be less. These are we're running 2,800 daily bus miles. That will drop. And so I think we have a pretty good plan. The difference between consolidation and cooperation, which is your key question, is it allows the independent school districts to continue to put their emphasis on the grade schools. And each one of these districts have great models that attract kids, and that's why they want to maintain their local control beyond all else. It also allows us the opportunity to consolidate once we're in a new building, if that's what the people would like to do in these three districts.
Thank you. And Senator Saxhart.
Yeah, that's a good answer. And then the second thing is, we just talked about the fact that you had three or four old high schools, and it wasn't worthwhile to fix them because there's so much. So what's the plan for them? You're going to tear them all down?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxhart. The plan is we have enough money in the proposed budget for demolition costs, specifically in the Virginia district. To give you an example, not to bore you with all these details, but the Virginia grades 4 through 6 is located on the same campus where the high school is, but that's a building that can be separated out from engineering. It includes a pool and includes a new gymnasium, which is the varsity gymnasium. So you'll be able to save the big assets that are needed for the community, tear down the excess assets, cut operating costs. Okay. And the same thing in the other two districts.
And so the answer to your question is that you're going to be done taking down the old schools, the ones that we're talking about are a lot of extra money.
Or repurpose if possible.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, you know, we've had the royalty tax that was repealed in 1986. It had been around since 1923. Does anyone can give me a little context or history why the royalty tax was repealed? Was that a indicative of the industry at the time, or was it about our own fiscal house here at the state? If anybody can give me some insight on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, I believe from my knowledge.
For the tape, Mr. Cervenek, if you could just state your name each time you
re-enter. Okay, sure. Thank you. Sorry about that. Gary Cervenek, representing the three districts. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, the history, to my knowledge, is that since the turn of the century in 1923, for 66 years, there's been a royalty tax of around 6%, an effective tax rate. It was actually as high as 14.3% at one point in time, but they got a labor credit for it. And in 1986, the industry, the tacking industry, was really hurting, and price of ore was down in the mid-20s, and so the Iron Range delegation met with the taconite industry and decided they needed a little break because of the drop in employment, the demand for new equipment, and so they eliminated at that point the royalty tax. Now, for 25 years, that's been the case. They've paid no royalty taxes. And how we look at this, I believe, is that the mining companies have big costs. They invest in equipment, in plant, in employees. What do the royalty holders have? These companies, Mesaba Trust, Great Northern Iron Ore Properties, those types of folks, do they own equipment? No. Do they own plant? No. Do they have a lot of employees? No. What do they own? They own the underlying mineral underneath the surface, and they've owned them for generations. And for generations, a lot of people have benefited who don't live in Minnesota from the wealth by workers who work at these plants who are trained in these schools. And it is our view that maybe those folks who've gained all that wealth deserve to put some money back into the systems that train workers to work at the plants to build their wealth. So it's a pretty easy argument, I think, to make for the public.
Thank you. Senator Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first question I have is on, there was some discussion about damage to the buildings from blasting. Is that in all four areas that there's being damage to buildings?
Mr. Chairman, Gary Cervenek, Senator. It is significant in the Mount Airy and Buell primarily. There has been damage in the Virginia School District as well. At one point in the last couple of years, they had to shut down a wing and evacuate 9 classes because of blasting damage to a wall. They've corrected that structural damage. In Eveleth, they're very close, but I'm not familiar if there are. We don't have any data on Eveleth, Gilbert, but 2 of the 3.
So Mountain Iron, and am I hearing Mountain Iron is receiving the most of the damage?
That's correct.
Is that not where you're proposing to build a new school?
Mr. Chairman, Gary Cervenek, Senator, we're proposing to build the school 2.3 miles away from the site of the Mount Airy High School in the new campus where the current new elementary school is, and it's off on the south side of Highway 169 away from the iron formation.
So do you feel there's going to be less damage there? Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Do you feel there's going to be less damage there, or would you be better to choose a different location where there's minimal damage, if that in true fact is happening, which I don't know what it is, but if it is, would you be better off to choose a different location so that you circumvent that in the future?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think that would be a wise choice. However, if you're familiar with the three communities, we're surrounded on 3 sides by taconite mines. We, all of our communities are surrounded. There's
almost nowhere we could put it that we wouldn't be fairly close to a taconite mine, because these cities and these towns were built up next to the ore body because that's where people went to work, where they could walk to work and transport easily. This is the best site that's available, and with modern building techniques, we think we can adequately address the problem.
And Mr. Chairman, also to that point, because that's a good question, Senator Deems, south of Highway 169 is where the Merritt grade school is located right now, and it's a newer school in the district. What, the 60s?
85.
Huh? 25 years, so that's really a young school for us. And they don't have any damage from the blasting. In this particular location, it'll be south of there, so that means that the mine is farther north. But you should get in a little plane sometime and fly over the Aran Range to see how some of these towns are surrounded by these pits and how there's no place for them to go. When our houses shake, it's kind of like, well, we understand that people are working, and so you just got to kind of put up with it.
One more question,
yes,
Mr. Chair. And this might be to Mr. Pagel. When you were referring to the money that was put into the K-12 Education Trust Fund, is that a statewide trust fund?
I'm not sure.
Mr. Pagel, are you referring to the Permanent School Trust Fund?
Yes.
And the corpus of nearly a billion? Yeah. Well, please proceed.
Craig Pagel with the Iron Mining Association, Chair, Senator. Yes, that's a statewide trust fund. Both the money that comes from the lands that are owned by the trust, as well as the occupation tax, 40% of the occupation tax goes directly to K-12 education. That might be another area that funding might be available, since some of it does go to the general fund as well, and it's directly from the mines. That's some of the discussions we've been having with the senator.
Just to follow up on that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Deems.
Mr. Pagel, do you think putting this excise tax on, can you tell me, do you think that's going to have any adverse effects on the mining that's going on?
Mr. Chair, Craig Pagel, the Iron Mining Association. Senator, yes, it's a $5.5 million cost to the mines. Over the last couple of years, several of the mining companies have not shown a profit. As we continue to have to invest in facilities in our own to meet certain environmental qualities, needs, studies that we're doing to meet those, that and just the expansion of the mines that are going on at this time. So it would put a burden on us that we're hoping that we can find another way around, maybe taxes that we're already paying.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Deems, just to be clear, the K-12 Trust Fund wouldn't be touched by what we're doing here, okay? And I think the mining industry is probably the only industry right now that is contributing to the K-12 Trust Fund. The logging industry might be doing a little bit. And
there's timber revenue.
Yeah, there's some, but there's, it's a small amount, and a lot of it gets used for administrative purposes. But the total of the trust fund right now is in the $700 million area, and it's projected to be in a very short period of time to be over $1 billion. And it's all those are royalties are going to be coming from the mining industry when they're mining state land.
So. One more question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Deems.
Mr. Pagel, can you tell me how many jobs are there in that community that deal with mining? Any idea?
Craig Pagel, Mr. Senator. Pagel. Directly in that district alone probably has the most employees, probably several, working directly in the mines, I'd say probably about 2,000 to 3,000 employees. In a study that we've had done recently, the University of Minnesota Duluth, for every one mine worker, there are approximately two other workers in the companies that supply the products and services to the mines.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chairman, I keep giving you new questions, Senator Deems, but I just want to make sure that everybody understands. MinTac is in Mountain Iron, and that's the largest employer. They have about 1,400 employees. And then Inland is right outside of Virginia, north of Virginia, and they probably have about 500 employees. And then Eveleth Tech is south of the area where we're talking about, and they have about another 500 employees. So, the three mines are just right around the area that we're talking about. So, and in fact, if you've heard of the discussion of Highway 53, that we have to move Highway 53 because of an agreement back in 1960 with the state, the Eveleth mine is right up to the edge of the highway, and it's going to have to pop through the highway in the very near future here, which is what we're going to do. So, the the magnitude of the industry is pretty impressive, and it's pretty interesting stuff. And if you haven't been through one of our mines, just let me know, because you should take a tour.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Tomasoni, members on the Permanent School Trust Fund, a few of us serve on that new advisory group, and there was a tour and up at the range during the interim. And each time there's a blast, it's for a mine, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars that ultimately goes in dollars that go to the classroom. And we are very aware of that, and it's rooted in our Constitution pre-state from the federal government in terms of land that's designated. But perhaps we'll get an update on that. And the fund actually is over $1 billion. We just had an update yesterday on that. And, of course, with various other developments under consideration, that could considerably appreciate. So, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tomasoni, thank you for bringing this forward. I'm intrigued by it. In 2008, 2009, I carried the shared services bill, and the whole idea, there's people nodding, people who didn't want me to pass it at the time, but the whole idea was just what you're speaking of, the idea that if we approach it as a co-locating rather than a centralized services or consolidation, it lets the heart and soul of these communities still have their pride, still have, you know, their own identity, still have their local control, but then you get to take advantage of, you know, the what happens when you have so many students. You know, I look at a school with 100 kids versus in the metro area when you get the benefit of what the combined resources give you when you have thousands of kids. And so I think this is a great, great approach that you're bringing forward. I trust you'll work it out with Mr. Pagel and have a solution that will at least, maybe not, you know, everybody will love, but perhaps they won't stop you. And then also just to mention, you have brought, you know, to my attention the opportunity of even moving this into the post-secondary realm with your university mining institute, because it's so important to keep these young people in your community to make sure that this industry grows and takes advantage of 21st century technology to grow safely. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Bonoff, because I don't want anybody here to think that that this is a done deal and everybody's agreed to it either, because
right.
As any of you know who have ever gone through any kind of a consolidation, the perception of a school being moved out of a community is always a real negative thing, and it's always a hard thing to promote. At the same time, we're hearing people say this should have been done a long time ago, and so there's sentiments on both sides of the issue without a doubt. And as all of us rural senators know, that one of our biggest problems is in keeping our youth, not only keeping our youth but getting professional people to come to rural Minnesota, is the fact that people who aren't from there very seldom want to move there. So we got to try and keep the people who are from there to stay there. And in order to get the professional people and to repopulate the populations in our mines, the education factor is very, very important, and getting them acclimated to what they might be able to do in this industry, because it's because the jobs are very good jobs, and we try and keep the young people around. And from from what I know, it sounds like we're going to be needing to replace 40% to 50% of the workforce in the very near future, and it's going to have to come from within. So I thank you for the comments.
Further questions from committee members? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address Senate File 2247? Okay. If not, Senator Tomasoni, your witnesses did an excellent job on making the case that there are old, inefficient buildings that need to be replaced. We totally support the idea of jointly working together, co-locating. Whether that leads to additional discussions, we'll see. We realized there was way over 1,000 independent districts in the state at one point, and now it's at 335 or so, and will further reduce. But the pride, the vitality of various communities, we understand that, and we also know that facilities should not be based on one zip code in terms of the opportunity, and you have amongst the oldest inefficient buildings in the state, and we've seen that firsthand, and that needs to be corrected. That said, there's significant tax revenue in play here, and this would need to be reviewed. And I know you have spoken to Senator Scoy about this, and so he's on call to review this in the near future. We would need to refer this to finance, the oversight of our division, like yours. And from finance, I assume it would be promptly referred to taxes, then referred back to finance as we look at the question over the next couple of weeks as to how we might underwrite such co-location opportunities. Because whoever takes ownership of it, whether it's through our target or through taxes, then they will underwrite it. So that would be the challenge. There's some additional questions that we would have on details, but I think at this point it would be best for us to consider referring Senate File 2247 as amended to finance. And if you're okay with that, I would ask Senator Stumpf to make that motion.
So moved.
Which is before us. Senator Tomasoni, would that
Thank you. That's
work?
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Very good. On Senator Stump's motion, discussion? If not, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. Thank you very much, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
Senator Johnson, Senate File 1891, increasing state aid for school breakfast, and we'll take that in about 2 minutes. Members, in addition to the bill, I believe we have three handouts, including a fiscal note. Senator Johnson, Senate File 1891.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm happy to be here. And let me tell you that the issue of food is becoming very, very well known as to be one of the ways that we can close the achievement gap and also take care of our children so that they can be avid learners. I'll have to admit to you that I shirked my duties back in 1998. I had promised myself that I wouldn't leave the legislature until I had passed a bill that would allow all children to have breakfast free. I didn't do that. I retired in 1999. However, I have in your packet.
You came back. You came back.
I came back. And that was one of the reasons I really thought about it very seriously when I was determining whether I would run again. So in 1994, that was when I first introduced that bill. 1994, 20 years ago. And I still have such a passion in my heart for this topic. The evaluation, you have a copy of the evaluation in your packet, and I'd like you to just take it in your hands, and I'll just try to say a few words about the evaluation that was done after the three-year pilot program for
Excuse
some
me,
of
Sarah
you.
Johnson, we're referring to school breakfast programs energizing the classroom?
Yes.
Okay. Summary of a three-year study.
Yes.
Okay. Please
so
proceed.
So we had the bill that set forward a three-year pilot program with actually, there were six schools that participated in this program. And if you look at the second paragraph on the first page, this evaluation was prepared from the by the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement at the University of Minnesota. And it says it shows that when all students are involved in school breakfast, there is a general increase in learning and achievement. And that is what I think we want to kind of focus on that, you know, most every school is required to have a school breakfast program, but it is only free to the people who are qualified as the free and reduced lunch people. What makes the difference with a successful program, or really to have something affect all of our students? And I think it's the stigma that's attached when you are asked to go to get your food in a place that sets out people who are low income. And that's not, I don't think, very pleasant for anyone. I thought about it just this morning. I said, if Senator Bach, our majority leader for our caucus, said, okay, why don't you all come over for breakfast this morning, but only those who are very low income can come for free. Otherwise, you'll have to pay. I don't think that we would be traveling to that office very readily. And so the stigma is what is really, I think, an impact. On the second page, it says, by involving all students, in the first paragraph that talks about participation, by involving all students, these pilot programs eliminate the stigma of subsidized meal programs. Students from all socioeconomic levels participate. Thus, on a nutritional basis, they all start the day equally. And then look at that next line. That participation rates at two of these schools that are mentioned, 75% participation rate, 93% participation rate in Oak Grove School. And after the pilot program was over and the schools went back to their other way of funding breakfasts, some of the participation rate went down more than 50%. Again, why? Because I think the cost and the stigma. So I hope you'll look at this evaluation done by a very credible institution, the University of Minnesota, and consider it very seriously. Even though it's dated, it's done in 1997, I would say that it hasn't changed. The only thing that's changed is that there are more people in our schools now than 20 years ago that are low income and often have times difficulty paying for their own meals. So I have today with me Craig Withington from the Department of Education as of today. And Craig is the director now. When I first met Craig, I was given the article that you have in your packets, Closing the Achievement Gap, A New Vision for Making It Happen. It was published in November of 2013 in the Min Post. And I read this article, and it became very important to me in my legislative career this year. And so I asked Craig to be with us. He was in the Department of Health at that time, but he's currently Deputy Director for the Division of Safety, Health, and Nutrition in the Department of Education today. Also, I have with me Peggy Flanagan, Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund. The Children's Defense Fund has taken on school breakfast as one of its main issues that they're trying to deal with. So with that, Craig, if I may, Mr. Chairman, go on with Mr.
Welcome,
Withington.
Mr. Withington.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, Senators. As Senator Johnson said, this is my first day on the job at the Department of Ed. I had orientation at HR at 9 o'clock, but here I am. They found out that their new employee's gone rogue and is up at the Capitol, so I'm worried about having a job by the end of the day. But as Senator Johnson said, my name is Craig Withington. I'm Deputy Director in the Safety, Health, and Nutrition Division at the Minnesota Department of Education, and I'm here today to talk to you about non-academic factors that can limit students' ability to learn. However, before I speak about the non-academic barriers that impact learning, I want to underscore two points. One, the importance of health and education working hand-in-hand in our state. And two, the undeniable link between healthy learners and a healthy economy. Minnesota's future position as a leader in the changing global marketplace depends on preparing today's students to compete and collaborate effectively. These are skills students can learn in school, but only if they are healthy and able to learn. Health and education are intertwined. Both are essential contributors to creating a healthy, productive workforce. In both domains, the state faces opportunity and risk. The opportunity to be the best, with the risk of failure. If we're to realize Minnesota's potential to lead and succeed in the 21st century, we cannot ignore the health and education disparities that limit the ability of our children to succeed in school. Our state stands at the top among states in national health and education rankings, but we also have earned the honor of having the highest health and education gaps in the country. Schools have a mandate to ensure that all students graduate with knowledge, skills, and motivation to become successful contributing members of society. Without question, all schools and districts want their students to be ready for and succeed at college, work, and life. However, school districts face many challenges limiting their ability to ensure that all students are ready to learn. These challenges include absenteeism, behavior and discipline problems, violence, truancy, and school dropout. These challenges are often linked to unmet social, emotional, and physical health needs. Meeting these needs requires multifaceted, complex responses, often exceeding a single school district's capacity. A recent review by Charles Bache of the Campaign for Educational Equity at Teachers College, Columbia University, titled "Healthier Students Are Better Learners, A Missing Link in School Reforms to Close the Achievement Gap," presented a persuasive case for why we must address non-academic barriers to learning in order for students to achieve. The report identified 7 educationally relevant health disparities that stand in the way of learning, disproportionately affecting low-income urban minority students in particular. The review argued that no matter how well teachers are prepared to teach, no matter what accountability measures are used, no matter what governing structures are established, educational progress will be profoundly limited if students are not motivated and able to learn. The 7 educationally relevant health disparities found in the Bache report are aggression and violence, mental health, poor vision, uncontrolled asthma, inattention and hyperactivity, teen pregnancy, physical inactivity, and lack of breakfast. Here's some facts about lack of breakfast and educational achievement. Diet has a persuasive and profound impact on human health. Specific nutrient inadequacies during childhood can affect brain development and have lifelong health and learning consequences. Breakfast differs qualitatively from other meals because it's typically eaten after fasting 8 to 12 hours during sleep. This time it has implications for how the brain responds and performs at school. A considerable body of research suggests that school breakfast has direct and indirect effects on educational outcomes, primarily by increasing school attendance and decreasing tardiness. Learning will be compromised if youth are hungry, absent, or late, yet too many youth, especially low-income youth, attend school on an empty stomach. In closing, unraveling the complex health factors impacting students' success will require shared long-term commitment between state and local leaders to collaborate and engage in problem solving so together the state, schools, and communities can address what we already know are the barriers to learning. Absenteeism, discipline violence, truancy, dropout are often linked to students and their families' unmet physical, social, and emotional health needs. Students cannot learn if they're not healthy, and if we are to realize Minnesota's potential to lead and succeed, we must address the educationally relevant health disparities that limit our students' ability. A high-quality workforce is also a healthy workforce. Supporting school health programs like school breakfast improves the health status of everyone. The health of young people and the adults they will become is linked to the behaviors they adopt today. Healthy students are more likely to become healthy adults and less likely to suffer from obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and injuries that cost Minnesota businesses billions of dollars to insure and treat. So thank you for your time today, and I look forward to working with all of you to make healthy schools a priority.
Thank you very much. And welcome. Congratulations on your new position.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Flanagan, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here as the Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. I'm also here as a recovering school board member. some of you, right, may understand. But I'm also here as a former recipient of free and reduced lunch. Children's Defense Fund Minnesota is a nonprofit child advocacy organization that champions programs and policies that strengthen the financial stability of families and improve child well-being. Our mission is to ensure that every child has a healthy start, a head start, a fair start, a safe start, and a moral start in life. We also believe that children need to be prepared to start their days ready to learn. Providing school breakfast is a common sense solution to ensure that this happens, and that's why I'm here speaking in support of Senator Johnson's bill. Through a grant from Hunger Free Minnesota, Children's Defense Fund has worked over the past year to increase the utilization of school breakfast through our School Breakfast Initiative. We have worked with schools across the state to help them implement successful school breakfast programs. We know that for the 2014 school year, the Department of Education has reported that there are over 327,000 students in our state that qualify for free or reduced price meals. These students often face food insecurity at home. School breakfast provides an opportunity for those students to receive the nutrition that they need. From our work on this issue, we know that offering universal breakfast can be an effective method to increase breakfast utilization among all students. By providing universal breakfast, we can also help to remove the stigma associated with free breakfast when it's offered to all students. We know how important school breakfast is to a child's health and development. For example, according to studies by the University of Minnesota, the Harvard School of Public Health, and a recent study by Deloitte No Kid Hungry, children who begin their day with a nutritious breakfast have recorded higher test scores, improved high school graduation rates, and reduced absences. And from our work, we've found that children have fewer trips to the nurse's office because of tummy aches. They also have fewer behavioral issues and increased engagement. On the other hand, children who go hungry are more likely to experience headaches, stomach aches, ear infections, and colds, are 2 times more likely to repeat a grade, 3 times more likely to be suspended from school, 2 times more likely to need counseling, 2 times more likely to suffer from depression, or 5 times more likely to commit suicide. To be clear, children experience higher test scores, better graduation rates, and reduced absences are less likely to experience negative outcomes, including increased health issues and decreased academic achievement, simply by eating a nutritious school breakfast. This is not new information, but has an established record of success. We have also seen examples from across the state of school principals bringing in universal breakfast on the days of the MCA tests. So we ask, why not every day? The benefits of school breakfast and the consequences of a child missing this important meal are too great for us not to act on this bill, and I ask you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Flanagan.
Mr. Chair, I have a letter also here from Hunger Free Minnesota that is in your packet. And, you know, if you read that letter, it is, it's like, it's crazy that we don't do this. It says this, the number of children that are in need of food, it creates an economic cost to Minnesota of $642 million annually. Now, I don't, you know, we would have to have representatives from the organization. Greta Gauthier is here. But if this is, in fact, true, and I believe it is, that would give us like $100, $100 for every dollar we put in this program. I mean, that's crazy. So, you know, looking at the fifth paragraph, the next paragraph after that, a 2012 study by Deloitte. Deloitte's study showed that if 70% of low-income students ate breakfast every morning in Minnesota, that would mean 62,000 additional school days attended each year, 41,000 students would have better math scores, and 10,000 additional students would graduate from high school. Now, again, if that is only half true, it would be a wonderful investment. You know, the rate I have gathered of schools that do have a universal breakfast program for their free and reduced, or they are required to have a breakfast program for their free and reduced children, there's about an 18% of, or 20%, let's say 20% of those students participate in the breakfast program. Why? We don't really know. I talked to Troy Ferguson, interim superintendent at St. Francis Schools, who he was quoted in one of the newspaper articles as addressing the lunch issue. So I called him and talked to him, and he said they have been working very hard at getting the families who are eligible for free breakfast, to fill out the form to do it. And again, that's a common thing. We have to find a way to make it acceptable to everyone. And in the study, the evaluation the University of Minnesota did, and everything else that I hear, is when everyone is eligible to go, the participation rate just goes up like that. So let's think about it that way. Mr. Chair, I have other witnesses. If you have questions for these people, it would be...
They could be on standby, Senator Johnson, but we'll proceed with the remaining witnesses.
Thank you very much. I think everyone here knows Superintendent Danny Carlson from the Anoka-Hennepin School District. He's come before this committee oftentimes, and it's only because there is so many students in that school district and there are so many good programs going on there. Also, Elaine Keefe, you all know, as the, with the Minnesota School Nutrition Association.
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Danny Carlson, Superintendent of the Anoka-Hennepin School District. School breakfast is important for all our students and critical for our students living in poverty. I'm in my 28th year in Anoka-Hennepin. We've seen our free and reduced lunch numbers double over each of the last three decades. It is now 35% of all of our students. If that growth continues in the next decade, it'll be over two-thirds of our students. Where Senator Johnson and I live in Blaine, we've got a University Elementary, which has 60% of our students receiving free and reduced lunches. Evergreen Park on our south side has 80%. And I just learned this week to let you in on the demographic change for Anoka-Hennepin in the last 28 years that I've been there. We now have 100 languages spoken in our schools. Our 42 schools have 100 languages spoken in the home. I will skip my remarks on research. Other testifiers have hit that hard, and I won't speak to that. But I'll say this. Students who skip breakfast lack the energy, focus, and stamina to reach learning goals each day. We hear from an increasing number of elementary students who get themselves ready for school each morning, and they choose whether or not to eat and what to eat. School breakfast would guarantee a nutritious option for them. For some of our students on free and reduced price lunch, it'll be their first nutrition meal since lunch at school the day before. Our students deserve every opportunity to start their day free from the worries or pain of hunger. School breakfast helps support our students and start their days off with a healthy start. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. And 28 years, we know that it's at least your tenure with Anoka-Hennepin is drawing down. How much longer will that be?
Is it down to days yet?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's this is what I'm saying to everybody I talk to these days. It's 3 months, 2 weeks, and 2 days, but who's counting?
Okay. You are?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make a comment regarding Anoka-Hennepin School District. For those of you who may not have heard me say it, month or two ago, we attended a meeting at the Anoka-Hennepin School District to talk about the issues there. It was there that I heard the assistant superintendent, I think it was Jeff McGonigal, assistant superintendent, say that they have food shelves in every one of their school buildings, over 40 school buildings in Anoka-Hennepin School District. They have food shelves. They send backpacks home with children on the weekend because they may not have any food over the weekend until they come back to school. Another thing, I had a visit from one of your teachers in the Anoka-Hennepin High School, and I got started talking about food, and she said, you know, I feed six students in my classroom every day. These are senior high students. She's in a program where she's helping to develop these kids to get out into the workplace because they are likely not to go to college. Six students that she feeds every day. And so, you know, and I say, you know, let's not criticize our schools. Let's criticize ourselves for being unwilling to see to it that our children get enough to eat in order to become the world's best workforce. So that's my little sermon.
Okay.
And experience.
Thank you. Ms. Keefe.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Nutrition Association. And our association is made up of school nutrition directors, dietitians, cooks, and cafeteria servers. Senator Johnson asked me to testify about our previous experience with Universal Breakfast. In 1994, when she was a member of the House, we asked Senator Johnson to introduce a bill to establish a pilot program where breakfast would be served free of charge to all students. She got it passed, and the pilot program was established in 6 elementary schools. You've heard some about that. The pilot schools were required to integrate breakfast into the school day so that all children had the opportunity to eat breakfast at school. Some of the schools served breakfast in the cafeteria right after the kids got off the bus, and others served it in the classroom. We initially expected that breakfast participation would be similar to school lunch participation, about 65%. Instead, participation ranged from 75% to 93%. One really great result was that participation went up substantially among students who were already eligible for free breakfast because the stigma was gone. Breakfast was free for everybody and regardless of their income. The pilot lasted for 3 years, and as you've heard, the evaluation was done by researchers at the University of Minnesota, and the results were very impressive. Test scores went up, discipline problems went down, and visits to the school nurse went down. Teachers who were initially apprehensive about breakfast taking time away from classroom time devoted to learning actually became big advocates of the program when they saw the great impact it had on their students. In 1997, the program was expanded after the 3-year pilot was done. It was renamed the Targeted Breakfast Program, and it was made available in elementary schools where 33% or more of the lunches were served free or reduced. Grants were made on a first-come, first-served basis until the appropriation ran out. We had many schools on the waiting list for it. Schools where 33% or more of the lunches served are free or reduced are mandated under state law to provide a breakfast program, and that's why that threshold was chosen. In 1999, under the Ventura administration, the program was renamed Fast Break to Learning, sports theme. And then in 2001, it finally became a forecasted program so that it was available to all elementary schools where 33% or more of the lunches were served free or reduced. And the University of Minnesota continued to evaluate the program every year, and it continued to show very positive results. Unfortunately, in 2003, the first year that the state faced a mammoth budget deficit, the program was eliminated. Senator Johnson's bill presents a great opportunity to guarantee that every child eats a healthy breakfast every day. Many school districts, as has been mentioned, provide breakfast free of charge to all students on standardized test days because they recognize that the kids can't concentrate and do their best if they haven't eaten a nutritious breakfast. We think every day should be treated like a test day, and so we urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that concludes the arranged testimony that I have. And I would like to say I applaud the governor. He has been very outspoken about the need for good nutrition in our schools. He's basically been focusing on school lunch. But I think when he hears about all of the children who are coming to school without food, that's too long for them to go without food. They need breakfast.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, for being a passionate champion for this cause and for testifiers. Is there anyone else that would like to address the committee at this point? Questions from committee members? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson, I guess I have quite a few questions here, but and maybe one of your testifiers could help out here. Is the academic problem that was noted by Mr. Witherington, I see the different problems that he recommends. I think there's 7 of them here. I didn't see sleep being a problem, and I didn't see exercise being a problem. Yet I thought I'd heard some of those as problems in the school where kids, if they'd exercise more, they would do better in school. If they would get more sleep, they would do better in school. And so my initial question is, are those problems too, or am I just hearing that from bad sources?
Mr. Chair,
Sir Johnson.
I think if you want to.
Right here, I can't do this one.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes. Nutrition and exercise and brain development.
For the tape, Denny Carlson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. Those are critical issues. Sleep, especially for high school kids. In our case, they're up 6:30 or 7, and they have a bus pick them up at 7, or they drive to school. But sleep is clearly an issue, as is exercise. The more recent brain research on that, we get to try to have our kids move around during the school day because that helps the brain development as well. So, yes.
Okay.
Sir, Mr. Wedlington, did you have an additional comment?
Craig Wedlington, Department of Education, Senator Chair. I would just agree with Mr. Carlson. You know, what the schools are focused on, what organ to keep healthy, is the brain. The brain needs nutrition, water, sleep, and exercise. So, yes, they are important issues. And we know through the Minnesota Student Survey that there are large gaps and a number of students who are not being regularly active and have other compounding health issues impacting their ability to learn.
And Mr. Chair, if I could comment, I think, you know, when you think about what can the school do, it's really difficult for the schools to impact on sleep. Exercise, definitely, and that's why I know there is some legislation about physical education classes, more physical activity in the schools, and I think our schools are trying to address that. But I think food is the basic most. That's one thing that we know everyone needs, absolutely.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the – I was thinking about the school breakfast, and I was also thinking about the obesity that we seem to have in kids growing up right now and how that related to each other. They're overeating, but they're not getting fed in the morning. Any thought on that?
Ms. Keefe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hall, I think the evidence is pretty clear that not just children, but adults who eat breakfast are less likely to be obese. Skipping breakfast leads to obesity because you overeat later. Having regular meals actually helps cut down on obesity. The other thing is, frankly, school meals are subject to very strict nutrition requirements from the federal government. And we've just gone through an overhaul of those. Last year, the new lunch pattern was implemented, and we've talked about that at length in this committee. This year, there are new requirements for school breakfast, and next year, the a la carte lines and the other competitive foods are going to be impacted as well. And so I think it's before this overhaul went into effect, studies showed that school meals were substantially healthier than what children who don't participate eat. And I think that's even more true now.
Sarah Hall.
Thank you. My last question or statement. It feels like we're going down a track, and maybe we've been doing this for years, where the state kind of takes over the responsibility of others and the responsibility of parents. And if we do that, I think many parents would love to give that responsibility up to a certain point, and especially if we do it very slowly, like the frog in the frying pan illustration. So if sleep's a problem, exercise a problem, vision, asthma, teen pregnancy, I'm not sure what you do with that, but why not house our students? Why make them go home at night? Why don't we house them, make sure they get the sleep? We feed them. Why not three meals a day? Is the problem the government? Is the problem the parent? Whose responsibility is it? If bullying's a problem, why don't we put cameras up every place, including restrooms? Why not watch them constantly? You know, I have a problem going down this road too far. We have a responsibility to educate our kids, but this is going way beyond that. And if the achievement gap can be taken care of by feeding them, we're feeding them all, or many of them now, have we seen the achievement gap get better for the ones we're feeding now?
Does anybody see that, or is it like I do, or is it that we really should be housing them and completely taking care of them and get them out of the home?
Superintendent Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I certainly understand the argument, and I've heard the argument. The first thing I'd say is, no matter what adults do, children should not pay the price. And that's something that we owe to our kids. It depends a lot on whether or not you want to have all kids learn or you just want some of the kids to learn, because the poverty and so on that we're seeing, the 100 languages in the home, all that makes it more difficult for kids to learn. We're providing mental health where we didn't do it before. I would applaud the Senate for the work they've done on the anti-bullying bill and the compromises you've done with that to make it a bill that Anoka Hennepin is proud to support. So I think, yes, am I aware of the argument? I'm very much aware of it, particularly in the demographics that I represent in a 172-square-mile school district being the largest in the state. I'm well aware of that. I just feel like if we decide to make our kids pay the price for the errors that the parents make, we're just creating a situation that will only get worse. And the world's best workforce that we all want to attain, that Craig mentioned when he started, unless you take care of our kids in a very comprehensive way, that day is not going to come. To the specific question on the achievement gap, yes, we are seeing great progress in the achievement gap. We have, as a district, one of the lowest in the states, and I would say it's all these kinds of things, nutritious meals, which we hired a chef a year ago to make sure our meals were not only nutritious, that kids ate them rather than throw them away. So we've done a lot of things. The other thing, when we've got achievement gap at the fourth grade reading level at 11%, and we've had our district-wide achievement gap as low as 17%. I would say to you, at this point in time, it gets tough to move the needle anymore. And school breakfast and doing some things we have not done before, I think, will make that even a lower achievement gap and again, serving our kids in a way that we can be proud of.
Leroy, you ready? Thank you. Senator Stump, followed by Senator James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to kind of shake my head a little bit because I haven't had much of a breakfast this morning. And I wake up.
I should have done that.
I just want to go back to the some questions about the fiscal note. And do we currently have, is there any federal money that goes into the breakfast program? See ahead. Ms. O'Keefe's head nodding. Then the question I would have is that if the way the bill I think reads is that each breakfast is paid fully. So is the cost? Do we mess with the federal match by the additional contribution that the bill makes? I'm just trying to understand this more.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, this will not impact the federal reimbursement that schools receive. I've got the rate sheet with me in my briefcase. I don't have the numbers memorized, but schools are paid a certain amount for a free breakfast, 30 cents less than that for a reduced price breakfast, and then there is a small amount for each fully paid breakfast. And in 2003, the state did, when the free breakfast program that was in some high poverty elementary schools was eliminated, two changes were made. The reimbursement for reduced price breakfast was increased to 30 cents, but with the requirement that those students not be charged. So that replaced the 30 cents that those families were paying, similar to what we're discussing doing this year with reduced price lunch. And then the reimbursement for a full pay breakfast was increased to 55 cents to encourage schools, if they could make the numbers work, you know, to try to get those full pay kids to continue to eat school breakfast. It wasn't particularly successful, although there are some schools that did were able to make the numbers work and did continue. This increase to $1.30 would ensure that the cost is covered between the federal reimbursement and the state reimbursement, but this will not impact what is paid by the federal government.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we would be covering between the federal and the state reimbursement at $1.30, we would be covering the full cost of the breakfast. It wouldn't fall back onto the local district?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, I think that that would be true at this time. One of the things that, if this went into effect, that we would have to keep an eye on is obviously cost climb over time, so we couldn't just, you know, allow this to remain flat forever, or else it would, then the cost would fall to the district.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, one other question is that this actually is covering the 2014-15 school year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I believe it's like for the year, starts with the year 2015.
Correct.
Fiscal 15
and 16. 2 million, I believe.
And Mr. Chairman, and maybe fiscal staff, the governor's proposal in the supplemental budget, that was for the same fiscal year? Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, again, the Hunger Minnesota, when they provided me some data, says only 45% of school breakfast meals available to low-income students are actually being served. So approximately half of the students who are eligible are not coming in. Now, if we could bring them in to get to have breakfast free, they would be coming, I'm relatively sure, based on the evaluation of the pilot project. And hopefully we could find those students, their families. When I spoke to Superintendent or Interim Superintendent Ferguson in St. Francis, he said that they have worked very hard. They when a child's account goes below $5, and if it happens regularly, they make an outreach to the family, and they talk to the family personally. They fill out the form for them, help them, you know, with them, fill out the form for them and get them qualified. That is how, I think, how proud people are and don't like to be singled out as finding out they don't have enough money to feed their children. How embarrassing, how humiliating that would be. For me, I know. And so I think there are lots of things that are going on. Here they say that we lose out on $50.7 million because we don't get those students. So, you know, the $6.7 million, even if it went to $10 million, it would be worth it, it seems to me. If we can look at the big picture and not just think about, parents should be doing this, not us. And I respect Senator Hall's question about it, because it is something that many people are concerned with, that that we don't overreach and try to do things that shouldn't be done by the schools. We don't charge students for textbooks. We don't charge them for many, many things. We mandate that they go to school. I think, you know, we should be held responsible if there are hungry children there and they're not able to learn. I think that we should take the initiative to try to address that issue, and that it should be pointed at the legislature, not at the schools or the school lunch people, for sure.
So. Sarah Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and most of my questions were answered with Senator Stump's questions, but I am concerned extending this to everybody across the board. I think that the folks that can't afford breakfast, I think that we ought to propose or be supplying a breakfast to them. But in a sense, I'm hearing that if we give it to everybody, we're going to get some of the folks that aren't using it now that can't afford it to come in, and I don't think that's going to happen. And I think that the other thing that Superintendent, I believe it's Carlson, Danny Carlson, brought up is that, you know, we're trying to help the heirs of parents that are not maybe doing a good job of parenting. So then my question to that is, if that's the case, then what are you doing in Anoka-Hennepin School District to get the children that are there now? What kind of programs are they, what kind of classes are they having and stuff so that when they get through school and get married and have children or however the process is going to be, what are we doing at our school level to help them be better parents so that we don't continually repeat these problems?
Superintendent Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members, you know, I don't know if there is a magic bullet for that either to assure you, Senator, that all our students are going to be good parents and take care of everything and be productive, but we're trying our best. We have many classes in many different areas, including basic kind of finance and parenting, and we have classes for our teen parents. I think we do an excellent job, and I could give you examples of some of the things our students have done. Some recently have been featured on national television just in terms of how well they have acted as young adults and how compassionate they are towards others and what good citizens they are. I think we do an excellent job. Are there challenges? Yes. And is everyone in our district, you know, a good parent? Well, we wish they'd be better. But we do things in community education with parent involvement. We do things as many possible opportunities we have. We want our parents to be engaged, involved, and active. But we're looking at a different society than when all of you went to school and I went to school. It's much more diverse. Immigrant families, the day Senator Johnson was at Adams and many of our testifiers celebrating our school breakfast challenge there, just had three kids straight in from Africa. Well, you know, that's going to be a challenge as we take them through our school. And they could speak very, very little English. But we're doing, I think, a great job, but the challenges will remain.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, and thank you, Superintendent Carlson, and certainly appreciate what you're doing and other school boards are doing to help with that situation, because you certainly have a lot of challenges, as you just talked about, no question about it, and it's not an easy job to do. But sometimes I think that we try to pick out a single bullet and say that this is the heel, all the and it's not. And it's part of a big puzzle. And so with that said, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, folks.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a comment in support of and compassion for people who have very little money and who have children that are sent out into the public and they cannot afford to give the fine nutritious meals that some of us can afford. And it is very sad. But again, I think we have to keep our minds on the return on investment here. If Art Rolnick were not down in Phoenix enjoying the warm weather and playing some golf, and he said he'd be back on April 15th. He deserves it, of course, but he'll be back on April 15th. He said that he has the one that's been put forward, the return on investment that we get when we take care of our young people, our future workforce, is so it's so clear that it is difficult to understand why very intelligent, compassionate, interested people don't pick out some of the simple things like food, is the way I say it. And I really hope that we can do something, if not this year, next year, but hopefully it'll be this year.
Thank you. Mr. Wilms, do you have additional information you'd like to share on the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I just wanted to provide some context and scope of the current breakfast program. It stands at $5.3 million for fiscal year 14 and $5.6 million for fiscal 15.
Is there anyone in the audience that hasn't testified that would like to at this time? Senator Johnson, thank you. We'll entertain a motion if you'd like to make that for
I would
move over.
That Senate file 1891 be passed and considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Or that Ed be Biden's laid over bill. For possible inclusion. Okay. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you very much, Senator Johnson. Witnesses.
Thank you.
Members, we'll meet again tomorrow at 8:30. The agenda's been published, and we noted a couple of the items for next week. If there's anything that you've introduced that you're requesting a hearing, please let us know today. Meeting's adjourned.